This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on Saturday the 4th of January, 2014, on Monocle 24. From women's wear to war reporting, the English countryside to the printing presses of Portland. We talked typography and trade print on paper stock in pink, buff or white. The 2013 Stack newsstand is full to bursting. So we take a look back at the very best of your favourite print media review show from the last year. In the next hour, we're going to go to the front line as we look back at a fully armed discussion on how to best report on conflict.
It is the value of this commodity called news. The commercial world doesn't like it very much, but human nature absolutely loves it.
From the battlefield to a bastion of British print, the rural and real estate idyll, the great country life.
It's a rather sort of strange beast. In terms of the advertising pitches, I would say, look, these guys are really wealthy, and they really want to be educated in how to use their wealth to greatest advantage.
And then from the shires to the shores of the Pacific, as we look back at broadcasts from Sydney, Melbourne and Portland.
If you go to any newsstand, you can almost imagine what the pitch was for each new title. Oh, this will be great for guys who love to buy lots of gear. Or, you know, this will be for the woman who wants to be the most fit woman in her yoga class. So, you know, we are perhaps the opposite of that.
Hello and welcome to episode 71 of The Stack, Monocle's weekly roundup of great print, perfect binding and smart periodicals. This is a special collector's edition, if you will, of The Stack, where we hear some of the best of what 2013 had to offer. It's been an eventful year both inside and outside Midori House, and as well as magazines and journals that are a treat to hold and flick through, we looked at a whole spectrum of printed material and the people who busy themselves filling the pages. As conflict has continued to rage in Syria, we looked at the business of war reporting with two seasoned journalists, the commentator and former editor of Britain's Channel 4 News, Stuart Purvis, and Robert Fox, defence editor of the London Evening Standard. We also heard from Perpignan, where the world of photojournalism met to buy, sell and discuss war photography.
So I'm Hugh Pinney, and I'm the Vice President of News for Europe, Middle East and Africa at Getty. Visa is a gathering point for the photojournalist industry, and it's a rare occasion where you will get publishers, you will get agents, you will get photographers. It's a giant meeting point, and it's a chance for photographers particularly, I think, to meet people who are, generally speaking, faceless names on the end of an email or potentially on the end of a phone, and to tout their wares, but to tout their personality and to actually look for means to further their own businesses.
When you're looking for new talent or established talent, perhaps, what do you go for?
In circumstances like this, you're looking for, on the one hand, the diamond in the rough, the undiscovered talent, somebody who is demonstrating that they have the flair, the talent, the skill, the bravery, the exclusivity, that little je ne sais quoi, which just brings their photographic work to life in a way that you may not have seen before, or somebody who has a different look, a different perspective on world affairs. And I think there are so many different approaches here, different people with different viewpoints, that you do get that broad cross-section.
And what kind of talent is available? With dozens of exhibitors spread out in Perpignan's ancient cloisters and churches, and some 4,000 photographer and industry insiders taking part, for 1 week, this town is a mecca for those who make current affairs into a visual product.
My name is Mohammed Mohsen. I'm with the Associated Press as chief photographer for Pakistan. Physically and psychologically, you're ready that you're going to a war zone and expect everything. But besides that, you have the material stuff which you have to be already aware of. For example, the protective gears, the helmet, the flak jackets, the expenses. In case you need a fixer, you need transportations, you need to arrange people on the ground to help you. So it's a big, big, big process. It's not just I'm going to the war zone, I pick my camera and I go. First of all, I'm a photographer. It means it's something I love to do. It's part of me, it's my passion, it's my life. Photography is my life. It happened to be a photojournalist. So I don't want to call it an addiction. it's some kind of a responsibility. Part of you feels responsible to cover a story. If I'm not in the war, I'm gonna miss my war. And if I miss my war, I'm not gonna forgive myself, but I know there will be another war. I'm born and raised in Jerusalem. I was raised with the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So this is where I found myself taking pictures. I have a degree in journalism and political science. I'm supposed to be writing, but actually my picture is my article. And all the stories that we are covering, we are not forced to go there. We are going there with all our conscience. It's part of you. The war is part of you, as life is part of you.
And I guess there's 2 points to this question. I mean, one, is it a changing landscape in terms of who the big players are going to be? And will there be fewer of them who can really, I guess, get their people out there and cover them properly?
There have always been powerful photo agencies, mostly based in Paris, actually, rather than in London. But the rise and rise of Getty Images is an extraordinary story. Now, of course, the oddity of the online world is that you can view Getty Images material online as a consumer. Mm. So if you want to look at the latest ray of pictures from a certain... It's the question that comes back. There's a really good point that was made about editing. I mean, if you've got the time, as some of us has, to actually go through these images... But if I look, for instance, you know, The Guardian's daily offering on their iPad, actually, I find that a little bit disappointing.
Mm. Robert, if we take it beyond even the photo agency, is it just going to be, you know, potentially the New York Times and maybe sort of, you know, the odd Japanese newspaper that will be, you know, right in there in the thick of it? And I say in the thick of it, being able to ensure their correspondents, you know, make sure that they're well and truly looked after, or will it be a broader field?
It's the looking after and the risk. You're absolutely right. The benchmark now is the New York Times. It's barely even Reuters in terms of reporting from the ground. It was always Reuters. And then the BBC did very well in getting in on the Reuters ethos. You look at the way that the Britain is going. I'm amazed. Sorry. And I think it is the effect of iPad and the apps. The Financial Times is no longer what it was under Freddie Fisher. It doesn't want to do the global context. And because it's thinned down that, it doesn't know, okay, I'm a bit up the old persiflage end of the thing. I was about to say old fart, so I'll say it. But you just... But the level of commentary really is not as good as it was 10 years ago, whether it's on Syria, whether it's on Fukushima. And that's the thing that worries me. And I think that it's a much bigger thing that you and Stuart are really talking about. It is the value of this commodity called news. The commercial world doesn't like it very much. Let's be very careful about it. But human nature absolutely loves it. It is part of gossip, rumor, information. It's the way we work as human beings. And there is a new conceptualization of news coming in, and it is not just owned by the big boys. And some of the big boys, like the BBC, I think, are in shock, even Sky, because we're getting new players, BT, Amazon coming in. But it is actually, it's the singer and the song, and great storytelling, which is what great news reporting can and really should be. The Rajad Kapuscinskis, the Vasily Grossmans, the Ed Murrows, George Lowther Steer, who really did cross the line, you know, who did reported Guernica. Yes, that tradition is as strong as ever. I think that people will go out and do that because it's not just money and it's not just fame. There's a sheer bloody-mindedness of curiosity that drives you.
That was Robert Fox in discussion with Stuart Purvis and the Stack host Tyler Brulé. As the English summer actually delivered some very decent days of sunshine, the Stack was transported to the countryside with the editor of Country Life magazine, Mark Hedges. Mark became editor-in-chief of the magazine in 2006, having previously fulfilled the same role across 50 IPC media brands. An award-winning campaign journalist, Mark's also been editor of Shooting Times and Horse and Hound, my personal favourite, of course. As you might expect, Mark is a keen countryman. He began by introducing this very traditional part of the British print landscape.
Okay, well, Country Life is a 116-year-old magazine, so you might start thinking it's rather dusty. But the fact is that the readers have the highest wealth of any magazine in Britain apart from The Economist. So you're immediately dealing with a rather wealthy group of people. They are people of culture and of taste. We split them rather interestingly into three different groups. There is a core country which might be represented by the Duke of Devonshire, who owns one of the great houses, Chatsworth. There would be a core culture group, which might be people like Brian Ferry, who famously named one of his albums and used all the fonts from Country Life, the 1974 album, I think it's called Country Life, with those rather delicious girls on the front cover. And then there is the core aspirational group, which is probably where most of the money is made. These are the people, whether they are, like when Madonna came to live in Britain and had her shooting estate with Guy Ritchie, or we have people like Abramovich who buy things out of the magazine as well. Interestingly, the Queen bought Prince Philip's Christmas presents out of the magazine last year. So it is an extraordinary mix to actually think that those two groups of people are actually looking in the same magazine for ideas and things. It is a relatively intellectual magazine. It is a very odd magazine because it's weekly. It's the only glossy weekly magazine left in Britain. So it's a rather sort of strange beast. But in terms of the advertising pitches, I would say, look, these guys are really wealthy and they really want to be educated in how to use their wealth to greatest advantage.
Mm. I want to go into numbers and business and a little bit later, as we were talking about at the top, or at least in the intro to the program, about some changes at the New York Times. But first, early on, Mark, you were just saying about, you know, the positive side, or at least the fact that you sort of paved that gravel driveway for everyone at Downton Abbey in a way. You know, when a program like this has gone global and you've just seen this incredible surge in the United States, has that also reflected now in Barnes & Noble, you know, ordering copies for the first time or ordering more? And has it done something also for subscriptions as well?
Well, I mean, our subscriptions overseas this year are up just short of 10%, which is a good start. I mean, Country Life is an interesting magazine. The last 3 years has seen three ABC increases, which is, for overseas readers, that means it's increased its sales the last 3 years, which is pretty unique in British publishing at the moment. So we are seeing a large, significant growth, faster growth actually overseas than we are in the UK, although we're growing in both places. I think... although I think Country Life will be the last magazine on the last newsstand, because I think as a paper product, it has the longest life you could imagine. And if it was mine, I'd actually improve the qualities of the paper and all those things, because I think that's the way to go. I think there is the fact that we can now reach people through the iPad edition in real time allows things like the antiques and art and also the houses to be picked up by the global audience. And we had very recently, there was a Dutch chap who in Brazil saw a copy of the magazine and ends up a week later buying a place in the south of France. And that's the sort of world that we've now got to sort of start be living in. There was a chap in Singapore who bought a rather beautiful chair off the page for £500,000. These are things that are a direct result of being able to get there in real time. And so that's what we're looking at. But absolutely, the paper product is what I think is the core of the magazine. And without it, it would lose its heart. It's a magazine that is there to last.
We'll be back right after this.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, where I'm taking you through some of the best from the show in 2013. Germany's robust publishing industry seems to be bucking the digital trend year on year, so where better to take the pulse than Berlin's legendary book and magazine shop, Do You Read Me? Tyler Brulé spoke to the owner and manager, Mark Kiesling.
In asking Mark about the notion of setting up Do You Read Me, and you know, clearly you've ended up in a very interesting position, Mark. Do you feel, Robert, that you've chosen the right path by going down more of a pictorial route, that there's a certain sense of being bulletproof, as you know, that you're not in let's say, the fiction market of doing pocketbooks? Do you wake up every morning and think, oh, thank God, I'm really not that bothered by what happens with e-readers? Because, well, who knows? I can't look into the Apple, Samsung, HTC crystal ball, but I can't really imagine that fully booked ink on paper is going to ever be something that I'm going to want to look at off a backlit screen.
Yeah, you're totally right. But I think what people do not really understand is that the digital book market is 2% of the overall market. In Germany, for example, it's 2%, so it's nothing. And at the end of the day, people always think it's the media, but it's not the media, it's the behavior that changes the market. So people are not really sort of replacing the real book, the hardcover, with an e-book, not at least in Germany, but what they're replacing is the time they spend on reading and the time they spend with a certain topic. That changes quite a bit. And so those guys really having problems are those guys who were heavily into paperback and into cheap sort of mainstream ideas because they have gone to the internet and gone to digital and so on and so forth. But I think with other content, you're still in quite a bit of a position to expand your business. And so it's definitely depending on what kind of content you have to offer.
Mm. What are the forces or peculiarities that keep sales in this 2 to maybe 3% region right now? What is it about the German reader?
I think, first of all, Germany is one of the countries where you still have a fixed price system for books, which means that if you order a book from Amazon or go to your local bookstore, it costs the same. So that, I think, is a major ingredient in the fact that there still is a German book and publishing market. Certainly, I mean, to a certain extent, you see the same problems that people are the chains are having in America, in Germany. You see Thalia going downhill, pretty much like Borders went downhill, or just have problems with Hugendubel and so on and so forth. So it's not that these chains or major outlets are unaffected and try to sort of replace that with more mainstream and more banal products and trivia and all that. Which didn't really work. But at the same time, you also see a specialized store like the stores that Mark is running, or you see bookstores specialized in other themes, whether it's history or sort of thriller literature or whatever. What these guys managed is to somehow attract a certain community of readers and manage to keep them interested and attached to the concept and also to the media. And I think that is something which some German bookstores do particularly well.
And from Berlin to another trend capital, Portland, Oregon, where the Stack was broadcast from the city's Ace Hotel, famed for a distinctly liberal, pretty laid-back attitude, where lifestyle is taken very seriously. We spoke to two men to try and translate this feeling into print. Soft focus with tones of white and buff, set against golden images of an ever-attractive, relaxed youth, quarterly magazine Kinfolk might be said to define Portland and many of its offspring. We spoke to the editor, Nathan Williams, along with Monocle's regular Portland contributor, Zach Dundas.
Kinfolk is it's a quarterly lifestyle magazine, and for anyone reading it for the first time, the subtitle kind of hints at the main purpose, which is now discovering new things to cook, make, and do. So it's an entertaining magazine, but the intention from the beginning has been to introduce a new idea of entertaining that's a bit more casual and intentional and meaningful. And kind of the second part of the goal has been for us to help that idea of casual entertaining feel a bit more natural and approachable for a younger generation. And so it actually started with a few friends in our last year of university. We kind of enjoyed hanging out and kind of cooking together and you know, testing out recipes. And there wasn't really a title that, I don't know, seemed to resonate with us. Mm. And so it actually was quite casual. We started the first issue with a focus on a digital edition. So we launched it online, and the intention was kind of just to test the market and see if there was interest for a title that we were interested in as friends. And so after we launched the digital edition, there was quite a welcome, warm response to it. And so we used that as kind of proof of the market and then kind of started talking with publishers, and they approached us. And that kind of, there was a publisher in San Francisco, Well to Know, that kind of took us under their wings and helped us to kind of learn the the ropes of printing and distribution and kind of get ourselves out there.
I also want to introduce my colleague, Zach Dundas. Zach doesn't just earn his keep with us. You are also a senior editor at the Portland Monthly. I always find quite fascinating that the U.S. is quite famous for all of these city monthlies. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. You can really travel the world, but it's one of the peculiarities almost of U.S. publishing that there's still so many cities that have not just one, maybe two or three glossy titles which represent the urban landscape. So within that, Zach, where does the Portland Monthly pitch itself?
It is a very interesting niche that does exist in most major metropolitan areas, and in some ways the magazines are throwbacks to what American magazines used to be, which is a big tent for a big readership. You know, you're trying to appeal to mom, you're trying to appeal to dad, you're trying to have something cool for the kids to look at. And in the same way that maybe Life magazine for a different era attempted to capture a pretty broad swath of its world, we try to capture a pretty broad swath of our world. Our world is the city of Portland and its immediate environment, or environs rather. So it's rather a small world, but we try to go fairly deep within it, you know. Mm. So we try to be a magazine that people at different levels of the socioeconomic ladder, people of different demographic backgrounds, would find equally useful and interesting to read, which I think is quite different to what most of magazine publishing has become, which if you go to any newsstand, you can almost imagine what the pitch was for each magazine, each new title. This will be great for guys who love to buy lots of gear, or you know, this will be for the woman who wants to, you know, be the most fit woman in her yoga class. So, you know, we are perhaps the opposite of that. What Kinfolk does so brilliantly is it distills a whole idea that is almost implicit when you read it and look at the photos and read the stories. I mean, you don't need to read some sort of mission statement or grandiose overarching declaration of what the magazine is about to really understand where you're coming from. And that, I think, in an interesting way, is something that magazines are distinctly and almost uniquely good for. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have this whole collection of disparate content that's united by one sensibility or an idea or a visual aesthetic.
I'm Tom Edwards, and I'm taking you on a special guided tour of the very best of the stack from the last 12 months. From Portland, the programme crossed the Pacific later in the year. In September, it pitched up in Melbourne, where we broadcast outside from the city's Federation Square. Tyler Brulé was joined by Jonathan Van Tiegelen, editor of Australia's printed Last Word in Politics, Culture and Analysis, The Monthly, together with Nicholas Carey, who's co-founder and creative director of Alchemy magazine.
We've lost a lot of what would have been our competitors in terms of Current Affairs magazine. We lost the News Weekly. The Bulletin, of course, went some time ago. There's quite a few have gone. So we're basically it.
Mm. But why is that? And you know, if you look at the latest round of ABC figures in the UK, for example, you know, business news and current affairs titles have been done pretty well. If some are growing, some are flat, and you know, of course, a couple are down as well. But it's actually a reasonably bulletproof sector of the newsstand. So you know, the territory that you occupy, is it because people are going to The Spectator and they're going to, you know, The Economist and picking up other things? But you know, yet here you have, you know, an incredibly important economy, and you would think that it needs its own reporting on a weekly basis or through a monthly.
There are competitors in a way. I mean, The Spectator here is not The Spectator it is in London, so it has some Australian content, but it's quite tokenistic in many respects. And we wouldn't like to see ourselves branded as a left-wing version of the right-wing Spectator. That wouldn't do us any good at all. Typically, we have been that. That is our image, but we've certainly, certainly since I've been editor, I've been very conscious of not just wanting to be a left-wing magazine. I just don't see the point of that.
Mm.
But that's my personal philosophy. But there's also an opportunity to move slightly more towards the centre, I guess, because there's no one there. I guess in Australia, we've always had a weekend newspaper reading culture. That was always the thing that the magazine I wrote for, the weekend magazine for the Sydney Morning Herald, Good Weekend. It was a joy to go out on a Saturday morning and see everybody sitting there in the coffee shops reading it. That hasn't happened so much of late. I think those weekend magazines have gone down market. Mm. They're more celebrity focused. They're cutting costs. They're looking shabby. The paper stock is poor. And all of a sudden you get titles like Frankie and Alchemy and new really quality titles coming up, and people just want them because they are just so handsome. It's a piece of art. You want it on your coffee table. I mean, I think they're just taking over from that weekend magazine culture to some degree.
Does it surprise you, Jonathan, that people at Fairfax and elsewhere never got that particular memo? Of course, there's costs associated with it, but you know, what do you think has happened?
Well, it happened very fast. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. The woman I consider the best editor in this country, just about, was my editor at Good Weekend in 10 years ago, Fenella Souter. And in 2004, I think it was, the magazine made $1 million a week in advertising. It was phenomenal. It was, we breached the $50 million a year mark, and that was its high point.
Yeah.
It actually peaked at that point in 2004, and then the slide was terribly quick. But it had the magazine, the weekend magazine, had a literary quality. It was edited for literary quality. It was on beautiful stock. It was big. It was thick. Yes, there was lifestyle stuff in there, but even that was done very tastefully, you know, and in depth. And then it just, at the top, people decided that those kind of magazines, based on experiences overseas, a few overseas editors came in, that those sort of magazines should appeal to women. And all of a sudden we had a directive that we needed to appeal to women. And what that meant was, in practice, for right or wrong, that they took it down market and it became celebrity focused.
Yeah.
We even had a mythical woman, Catherine somebody her name was, coming out of the focus groups, who was 37, had two children or one child, you know, had a lifestyle, and that was the person we were writing for. And all of a sudden, of course, the whole thing just collapsed.
That was our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé speaking with Nicholas Carey of Alchemy magazine and Jonathan Van Tiegeland of The Monthly in Melbourne. At home in London, live from Midori House, The Stack played host to many of the most influential voices in the print industry. As diverse and varied as the industry itself, during the course of the year, the show has spanned all the issues that both the seasoned editor and the budding new creative director are likely to have come across. Back in January, Tyler Brulé spoke to Caroline Daniel, editor of the Weekend FT, and Andrew Harrison, editor of Q magazine, one of the world's very best-selling music monthlies.
I think the word was niche inside niche inside niche, which made it extremely difficult. If you're a music magazine, you're attached to an industry that was the patient zero for digital malaise. You know, the music industry, Coach and Horses went through the music industry when the digital revolution took place. And when they're your key source of advertising, you're slightly in trouble. So Minnow's like word, very, very sadly, it doesn't look like there's a print future for that kind of thing. Possibly online, but not in print.
But it's curious, and I'll throw this out to both of you. You know, week in and week out, we have so many people coming in with titles which are a niche within a niche within a niche.
Yeah.
You know, we could go on, and there seems to be this incredible surge, you know, in very, very narrow publishing. And do you think just because of the very nature of what the word was covering, because so much of it is online, that this is just something naturally people, you know, will not gravitate to print for?
I think it depends on how valuable your niche readers are. And the words readers were very upmarket. They were very wealthy. But the kind of title that you had to put out in order to compete with larger publications, the quality, the pagination, even down to the paper quality, puts financial soundness out of reach. You know, I think you can do nano music titles if you want to. You can look at a circulation of 4,000, but you'd need an expensive cover price, and somebody's willing to pay £10 for a music magazine. It's a fiercely competitive market.
Before we went on air as well, we were just talking also about Rolling Stone as well, and the Jon Wenner empire as well, looking for, you know, another round of well, refinancing, etc. Do you think even that is a title as well that iconic in name, but is certainly not ring-fenced in any way?
Well, here's just something on the word iconic, which I pulled out from an online analysis last week. It said, to judge by the body count in recent years, iconic is more nearly a synonym for screwed. So, you know, and it cites, you know, Newsweek magazine, which has just gone, you know, gone off print, Playboy, not sure that's iconic at something else, probably. Business Week sold for $6 million, you know, TV Guide sold for a dollar.
Right.
You know, iconic is no longer enough.
You mentioned Business Week, but that's a title that comes up again and again on this program, that since Bloomberg have you know, had their mitts on it, people really love the reinvention of that title. I think there are many question marks about how well it's doing on newsstand, etc. I'm going to ask you, what do you make of that? And just the weekly in general, whether we're talking about The Economist, does Time have a few future et al.?
I think, I mean, if you look at The Economist, I think if you're looking at the kind of readers The Economist has, which is similar to some of the weekend FT readers, people, what is limited on the internet is not information, it's time and authority. The Economist still has that. The FT still has that. Publications like Business Week still has that. You've got executives who have limited time and they want it all in one place. Mm. And all those publications are still catering for that very small demographic, but thank God they were willing to pay for it.
Mm. I mean, I heard some frightening quotes, maybe taken slightly out of context, but they seem to be relatively, you know, firsthand. But just the view of some editors at The Guardian as well. In this city, yes, a lot of value put on their people in the ground and their best columnists and all of that. But then the other side, many people saying, well, you know, maybe this paper just needs to be literally the paper of the people. And it can be, you know, there can be a couple of people on the subs desk, but we'll just have the voice of the readership. I wonder what you make of that, Andrew.
I think that's a nightmare future to me, not just because it puts me out of a job, but because, you know, where's the objectivity, where's the sense check? You only got to dive down into the comments of every newspaper in the world to see what a seething mass of craziness it can be. And I'm not sure I want the people who write the comments in The Guardian writing the news in The Guardian.
That was Tyler Brulé speaking with Caroline Daniel and Andrew Harrison. Later in the year, in November, The Stack had another special theme show, Cartoons and Satire. Nobody, of course, better qualified to help us look at that than Private Eye's cartoonist of 30 years, Nick Newman. I spoke with Nick about the wry, traditionalist but anti-establishment, light but hard-hitting magazine that's become an icon of British print.
It's a sort of school magazine approach, really. You know, Private Eye sort of was launched on the back of school magazines and university magazines. When I was at university, that's what we did. We mixed up cartoons and the odd serious piece with jokes. It's a sort of great sort of scrapbook feel, I think. I think, you know, it's what makes an interesting magazine. And all of my favourite magazines are very much in that vein. I'm a big fan of the New Yorker journalism. I'm less of a fan of their cartoons.
Well, that's interesting, because I wonder, with your sort of cartoonist hat on, how tricky is it when you sort of look through the opposition?
Most of the time, if you see something good, you just feel very annoyed. The New Yorker, I think, the cartoons are sort of a very much of their own world, and they sort of define it as a sort of New Yorker way of thinking. And so you get an awful lot of stuff that I just don't understand at all. I think there's a very different sense of humour between British magazines and American magazines. Some, I don't know, there are some fantastic standalone New Yorker gags. And one of my favourites of all times is a drawing of a man drowning and he's shouting, Lassie, get help. And then you cut to Lassie lying on the psychiatrist couch. I suppose that's sort of quintessential New Yorker cartoon. But that would work in Private Eye or Punch as it was, or, you know, it's just a great gag. But a lot of them are sort of people saying, buy high, sell low, Mr. Applebaum, and you think, what's that about, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the other thing they don't have, which I do think works in Private Eye really well, is those sort of satirical strips, which I think are my favourite element of the curation of that. I like the individual one-offs, but the way that they just don't do satirical cartoons. They don't bounce off the news.
British device, the sort of topical gag. I know the French don't do it. We specialise in pocket cartoons, and Private Eye has three types of cartoons. We do strip cartoons, which are a sort of dying art, really, and we're trying to keep that going. The topical pocket cartoons, which is sort of thing that I do, and then there's the standalone gags, which most of the jokes in the 50 years of cartoons are those standalone great all-time gags, like the New Yorker gag.
Stephen, did you share that view? Do you think there's a sort of a peculiar sensibility that the Brits have that make them particularly good at that? Is it a refined humour, or is it in some ways it's actually a more sort of honest humour? Poking, you know, willingness to poke fun, even, you know, be a little anti-establishment, but not to lack too much deference?
I've been talking oddly to the, whether you call them satirists or not, two British comedians called Punt and Dennis, who certainly aspire to satire with radio and live shows. To a degree, their feeling was that satire is a very, very British institution, but perhaps it's why we haven't had a revolution for a long time. It's this little pressure valve.
Yes.
We feel that in laughing at someone, we let loose a tiny bit of that anger. We tend not to barricade the streets anymore. I mean, I think it's an arguable point, but I think it is definitely a case that I think the British often feel if they've laughed at someone, they've kind of done half the job of bringing them down anyway. You know, once we've laughed at the Prime Minister, and It takes a while. It still seems that people are trying to get a hold of Cameron a little bit. It's not quite being pinned down, but it took a while to get Blair. But once it's got, then there's almost like a victory on the, oh, we've got him. We know how to mock that person. And I think it's very British.
I mean, there are odd cartoons in Private Eye which really do make a difference. I mean, there was a Timothy Birdsall cartoon in 1963, which was a sort of, Timothy Birdsall died very soon after he drew the cartoon, which is rather tragic. But he did this quite elaborate cartoon about the last days of Macmillan, and he drew him as a sort of Roman emperor. And there was this tiny little joke in the background, which was a sort of motto, a sort of sign on the wall saying, it was like a sort of a Bunga Bunga style party going on at Cliveden. And it just says in the background, per ward you are, ad Astor. And it's a joke about Stephen Ward and the Astors, and it's a play on the RAF motto, per ardua ad Astra. Stephen Ward saw this reference to himself and thought, aha, they know what's been going on, and came round to the offices and spilt the beans. And it was just, that's how Private Eye got the whole Profumo story, through that cartoon.
That was me speaking to Private Eye's very own cartoonist, Nick Newman, and Monocle's regular media analyst, Stephen Armstrong. Amongst the hundreds of titles that are reviewed and discussed over the course of a year's worth of the programme, one magazine is mentioned again and again, one that's becoming a classic in terms of design, photography and editorial content. The Gentlewoman is only released twice per year, but has enough packed into each issue to keep the aficionados engaged. For episode 55 of the show back in September, Tyler hosted this fine publication's editor, Penny Martin.
What I'm hearing is, with the magazines that are trying to be shoppable, that the agents are turning around and saying, well, this is a slightly different prospect and a different consideration. And some of the figures that are being quoted for what's a sort of quasi-editorial shoot and isn't, basically the agents are standing up for their artists and asking for quite a pretty penny. And I think it's quite a shock. One of the things I wanted to mention, to twist it back to magazines from advertising slightly, was I don't know if both of you saw a very interesting piece that Eric Wilson wrote in the New York Times, a sort of digest of the September magazines, talking about basically how shocking many of the monthly magazines' front of book now is, because they're so sort of paralysed by the response, the pressure to respond to online, that the front of book just looks like a really bad sort of shopping page that's online, and how poor the editorial standards are. And what, from my point of view, what a surprise it is for some of the kind of blue chip editorial magazines to be so scared by online that they're not exercising the standards that they previously did, you know. And some of it's true. Some of the monthlies that you read, I'm not going to mention who they are, but we know who we're talking about. That would never have made it past the proofreaders before, but it's as if likes are exerting the authority and not the sub-editors, you know. And there's these kind of terrible little pieces about that are so product-led as to be totally facile. And I feel like actually that's the interesting point in editorial at the moment, is that the front of book is in crisis. It's got to rewrite itself into something substantial. I mean, I would say that, of course, because I don't have shopping pages at the front of my book and I'm very personality centred, but I'm really patting myself on the back or sighing a heavy sigh of relief that we didn't go down that line, because, you know, it's being heavily criticised and I think the readers are very literate of it. They know exactly what's being done, you know, and how poor it looks. I wonder whether people will look back at this period in history and, you know, in some places, and look for the kind of definitive Avedon photography or the amazing long form journalism, and look at our mainstream magazines and wonder why on earth they're not publishing it, and why it's these kind of pages of kind of repurposed online street photography images. Now, they've got their place, but it's strange that we've been so quick to just throw away something that we're working up for like 100 years as the kind of definitive, most beautiful, most seductive expression of our times and our clothes and our attitudes and our beliefs. And then, you know, kind of be reduced to kind of love the shoes. You know, how did that happen in 5 years flat? You know, it's astonishing. But I don't want to kind of tailspin into a negative rant. That isn't my experience, is the lucky thing. I meet our readers at readers' events, and you have them too. And they say, I love that you give so much room and so much thought and so much time that is so developed. And I think that a lot of the good magazines are realizing that this is their opportunity to be different, to concentrate on quality. I mean, it's not that hard. This is what we did in the 60s and 70s. I think let's just stop, turn around and go back to what we were good at. And I don't think that's too difficult. And, you know, and I think the clever people understand that.
That was Tyler Brûlé in conversation with Penny Martin, editor of The Gentlewoman, and we'll be back right after this.
The Arctic has inspired artists for centuries with tales of adventure and exploration. Monocle Films made its own expedition to Denmark to see the Louisiana Museum's Arctic exhibition to seek out the past and the present of this mythic place.
As nations are vying for the north, negotiating trade routes and expanding development, and the Arctic landscape threatens to disappear, this exhibition takes a visionary stance that activates dialogue on every level, from science to pop culture.
Arctic Inspiration, premiering in the film section on monocle.com.
You're listening to a special edition of The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Discussion, design and editorial critique, and importantly, the latest industry news. The Stack team is always trying to make sure our listeners are left very well informed. 2013 was the end of an era for one iconic newspaper title. In October, the famous International Herald Tribune became the International New York Times. Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson headed to the Euronext stock exchange in the French capital to catch up with the paper's management team at the opening bell.
For those that fear that somehow with this new name, New York Times, that the international nature of the content is going to change, that's simply not going to happen. We want to reinforce it. And why? Because our ability to get people to buy our content online is going to be dependent on that international sensibility. We've added, with this rebrand, we're adding up to 23, 24 new regular contributors to our opinion pages, the vast majority of which are non-American names. We have Indian writers, we have an African writer, we have Chinese writers, we have Russian writers. There really is going to be an emphasis on maintaining, cherishing, and nurturing that international sensibility that we're known for.
For so many people, the name, the IHT, has been iconic. It's a very easy to say acronym. What do you think about the new name's acronym?
Well, again, for the UK audience, we're hoping it's not going to be in it. So we'll see. We'll have to live with it and see what spills out. What I believe is important is what falls beneath the name, in a sense. The proof is going to be in the reading. Is the content shaped for an international audience? Does it feel right for that rather pretentious phrase we have, global class of citizens, that the people that are working for multinationals, organizations who travel all the time, who need to be connected in this increasingly connected world? Does our content resonate for them? Does it resonate for them in print? Does it resonate for them increasingly online and on mobile platforms? So that's the issue. Now, how people will end up calling us, we'll wait and see.
Stephen Dunbar-Johnson talking strategy to me there on the sidelines of the celebrations at the Stock Exchange, where the New York Times senior management team was invited to ring the bell and start the day's trading in Paris. Well, I'm now going to cross town to the La Défense district on the edge of the French capital, to the headquarters of the International New York Times, to speak to the Europe editor, Richard Stevenson, to find out more about the content and editorial focus of this newly named publication.
Really, what this is doing is signifying to our readers that we want to be a single global news operation across all platforms, print and digital, working together to give people news wherever they want it, whenever they want it.
Just looking through the newspaper, which I have a copy of in front of me, similar layout, as you say, but a couple of changes perhaps on the inside page, on page two.
Page two is the page that we have changed most. It's the one thing that will really look different to readers. It's intended to display our photography in a much more prominent way, to show off our ability to tell stories visually. It is also going to include comments drawn from our website, from readers, to display in print the idea that there is really vibrant conversation going on online among our readers, engaging with our stories, expressing opinions, and hopefully, you know, suggesting to some of our print readers that they might want to go online, take part in that conversation, and maybe even become digital subscribers if they are not already.
Do you think it's risky for a newspaper as recognisable as the IHT to change its name? Do you think there was any objection perhaps to this, certainly inside the organisation?
I think the risk would have been not to change. The business of journalism, such as it is changing very rapidly. We need to change, and we need to change in a way that gets ahead of those trends and pressures. And we think that our brand name, the New York Times brand name, stands for the kind of high-quality journalism that people will want to choose to go to amidst this cavalcade of competition and kind of, you know, what we refer to here as commodity news. We want to provide people with news, analysis, opinion, perspective that they can only get from us, and that ultimately, frankly, it is worth them paying for.
A newspaper with an amazing history, now operating with the fourth name in its 126-year-long life. But some final words of reassurance to the publication's 250,000 readers. Despite the new masthead and some changes to the layout, the rebrand has not meant a reinvention of the newspaper that we expatriates will doubtless continue to refer to as the Trib for some time to come. For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
That was indeed Monocle's man in Paris at the launch of the International New York Times, formerly known as the International Herald Tribune. The end of an era, caught for you here on The Stack. And for our last top pick from the year that was on The Stack, the conversation stays in Paris, where a magazine synonymous with all things feminine launched a title for some more stubble-sporting, trouser-wearing readers. The launch of Elle Man France came at rather a surprising moment, and Monocle's in-house Parisian, Daphne Denis, spoke to the man behind it all, Edouard Dutour, Elle Man's editor. Back in the studio, we'll hear from two seasoned magazine hacks, Ian Birch, director of editorial development and special projects at Hearst Magazines, and the art director, editor, writer and photographer, Francine Lawrence.
Je suis un homme. I am a man. The famous Michel Polnareff song could become the motto of Elle Man, the latest magazine venture of French publishing giant Lagardère. At first, the name choice could seem odd. Elle is first and foremost a French women's magazine and a brand that has taken over the world. And of course, translated into English, the title means she, not the manliest of pronouns. Still, that's not something Edouard Dutour, Elle Man editor and longtime Elle woman writer, worries about.
Our aim is to create a magazine that clearly isn't perceived as a supplement to Women's Elle, written by the women from Elle magazine. It's really a paper for men, produced mostly by a male team. But we've kept this little Elle on the front page. You can see that the Elle on the logo is pretty small, like a good fairy overlooking a cradle, almost. The thing is, I'm a child of Elle. I've spent 12 years in this newsroom. It was my first internship. It's the only thing I've ever done. I'm so impregnated with the values from Elle, and I've used that to create this magazine.
Unlike its prestigious female sibling, Elle Man France is not the first of its kind on the global stage. Male versions of Elle magazine are sporadically published in countries like Canada, Romania, or Hungary. And in China, Elle Man has become an extremely successful monthly.
In most countries, Elle Man is still just a magazine supplement. But it's true that in China, it's a monthly that has had extraordinary success. It's really simple. The Chinese market is booming, and the magazine has taken advantage of that. In France, print is going through a crisis. But when we saw the success of Elle Man in China, we thought we should still give it a go in France. I think that both the advertising market and the public are ready now.
For now, though, the French Elle Man is only published every 2 months, a periodicity Dutour believes fits male demand better than the weekly turnout of the female Elle in France.
D'autres choses. Alors, qu'est-ce que vous voulez que je vous dise? Que je commente le journal?
Ouais, un peu, oui.
Alors, écoutez. Moi, il y a beaucoup de choses que j'aime bien. Par exemple, j'aime beaucoup ce petit.
Leafing through the first edition of the magazine, Dutour points out his favorite sections in Le Numéro 1. a reportage on the changing face of the Pantin suburbs of Paris, from ghetto to the home of Hermès, a portrait of future presidential hopefuls, a somewhat surprising investigation about addiction to Viagra, and of course, some men's fashion too.
For a long time, there have been men's magazines with abs on the front page, with big cars, with naked ladies, with very expensive watches and with wine. Magazines that tried to justify their own masculinity. But you see, I prefer talking to men than about men. I think our target is a man that knows how to wear a black V-neck, who knows how to match it with his other clothes, and who wants to speak about something other than the fact that he is a man.
Still, in case you had a doubt, the blue and white colors of the magazine, as well as its minimalist design, are there to remind you that the main target is l'homme, le vrai, the real man. So what if women want to read it too? Well, that would only be fair, Dutour says, considering that 20% of women's L readers already are men.
Je suis un homme, je suis un homme.
Polnareff's song indeed sums up El Man rather well. I am a man seems to be the message of the magazine, not a cliché. For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Daphné Denis.
Pas besoin d'un référendum, ni d'un expert.
Report on El Man there with two experts in the studio. Ian, what's your impression of the title? Maybe describe the what I think is a rather quiet cover.
It's a very quiet cover. It flies in the face of all the usual newsstand rules, but I rather like that because I like the fact they're breaking what are the traditional rules. But I think it's an interesting time to come back. What I was really interested by in the interview was when somebody said that 20% of L readers are men.
Mm.
That really is amazing. And maybe they're just talking about French L as opposed to L as a franchise. But even if it is, that's still amazing. And if that is really true and why wouldn't it be, then it's a really good opportunity to think about launching this franchise.
Mm. Francine, what were your impressions?
Well, first of all, I thought, when L, man, two absolute opposite words, made me realise how powerful magazines have become in terms of brands. You know, when a magazine title becomes a brand, you can almost do anything with it. You can put it on anything.
Mm.
So the fact that you could produce a men's magazine with the word L on it, I think just shows, that they've tapped into something. As a magazine itself, I can't say that I'm overwhelmed. I think they could have done something, at first glance, a little more exciting. It does look quite quiet, but then maybe that's right for the market. I also think it's rather interesting that the French magazine is called El Man. So if we had it here, would we call it El Homme?
Well, that's an interesting point because when we did it back in the late 80s, the logo was the complete opposite of what we see here. So El was across the top of the...
So you're employing the brand?
Completely. Mm. So we went very big on El. Probably that was a mistake, but we thought, like you, it's such an important brand.
Right.
And the man was kind of quietly to the bottom of the right of the logo.
Mm.
And I suspect it may have been called El Homme rather than El Man, which again is a distancing effect, I think. And I think this thinking is much smarter than our thinking was back in the late 80s. But then obviously the market has changed. And I agree with you. I like the fact it's so understated.
Mm.
Because that makes me feel more comfortable. It makes me feel I'm not being shouted at. It makes me feel there's a more respectful relationship with the consumer.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we have to do more and more in the future with magazines. The cover has to say community almost more than those kind of shrieking headlines. Mm.
And you just heard there from El Man in Paris with Tyler Brulé in the studio with his guests Francine Lawrence and Ian Birch. And that brings us to the end of this special Best of 2013 edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. The show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Claire Urban and Jack Phillips. If you have any comments or queries, as always, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we'll be back each Saturday through the new year at the same time. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or at iTunes. But for now, until next time, it's goodbye and have a very happy 2014.